HyperCard was a primer for the digital age. So, if I wanted to make a HyperCard stack of personal information, I might have a home card reading me. On it would be an array of buttons, ranging from ones labeled timeline, people, writings, schedule, and other paths to branch from. Hitting the timeline button would bring a scroll bar from birth to the present. Stopping at a given point would yield a year, say 1988. A list of events from that year would pop up. Publication of second book, for instance. Selecting that choice would show a cover of the book and a row of buttons, giving the choice of displaying a list of reviews, the complete text of the book, sales figures for the book, or a video and audio clips for my promotion of the book. Click on the Reviews button, and you are linked to a copy of the review laid out graphically as it first appeared. Click on the name of the reviewer, and you see his or her biographical information. There might even be a response button that would yield any letter I wrote commenting on the review. As Vannevar Bush had hoped for his Memex machine, HyperCard was even capable of charting the sorts of connections an individual mentally mapped out all the time. Your own personal web of links could be seen as a fingerprint of your interests. HyperCard, in effect, taught you about your own brain, the leaps of logic and inference it took. No wonder that when the product was finally released, one of its several mottos was freedom to associate. Within a few months after his celestial revelation, Atkinson had a mock-up of the program. But he was reluctant to show it to anyone at Apple. He doubted whether the company would pledge sufficient commitment to fulfill the promise of HyperCard. In addition to the psychic pain of the Magic Slate rejection, Atkinson was smarting from Apple's haphazard support of Mac Paint. Though Apple had serially assigned several programmers to update the heralded product, the revisions were late and not particularly innovative. Worst, Apple had stopped bundling Mac Paint with every Macintosh, depriving Atkinson of the widest possible audience. Atkinson believed that in order to avoid a similar disappointment with his new creation, he would have to leave the company. No less a luminary than Alan Kay heard about Atkinson's imminent departure. Kay, who had become sort of a high-tech Rasputin to Apple's chairman, alerted Scully, who immediately requested an audience with a disgruntled software artist. Atkinson showed Scully the prototype, and the former sugar water salesman was blown away. It was exactly the kind of world-changing innovation that he wanted to be associated with. "What do you want?" he asked Atkinson. "I want it to ship," said the Apple fellow. They cut a deal. Apple would either bundle HyperCard with every computer it sold or grant full ownership of the product to Atkinson so he could sell it elsewhere. Using his home as a development center, Atkinson led a team of several programmers in creating the product. It took almost 2 years, but by the time it was complete, HyperCard was a brilliant exploitation of the Macintosh's abilities. The program made it abundantly clear that the Mac was the first engine that could vivify the hypertext dream. One could hack out Vannevar Bush-like information trails by a few simple manipulations and clicks of the mouse. John Scully himself took great pleasure in introducing the product at the August 1987 Macworld Expo, calling it the most important product he had been associated with since coming to Apple. Later, he claimed design credit for many of its capabilities, including its ability to connect to optical media such as CD-ROM discs. HyperCard made quite a stir at the show. The development team, recognizable by their custom-made royal blue bowling shirts, were accorded celebrity status. If you were lucky enough to run into Atkinson himself, finally accorded the Apple superstar status that he richly deserved, he would slip you a floppy disk with a special set of HyperCard stacks. It seemed, in some respects, like the dawning of a new era, the age of hypermedia, where the common man would not only have tremendous access to previously elusive shards of information, but would actually become a master manipulator of that information. Danny Goodman, the computer journalist and technical writer whom Apple had chosen to write an official handbook to the program, was so inspired by this capability that he immediately wrote a complicated HyperCard stack to organize his life, address book, scheduler, etc., with everything cross-linked. It was to be an example of this new era when people with little experience or inclination to be computer programmers would actually be able to design sophisticated applications. As it turns out, some of these dreams were overly optimistic. even though the scripting language for HyperCard, called HyperTalk, was one of the least onerous high-level computer languages yet devised, it was still a programming language. For most people, programming a computer is fine if you could do it as painlessly as rearranging a desktop, inserting a formula in a spreadsheet, or redesigning a layout of a pinball machine by moving around the bumpers and slots, but not by learning a new language and syntax and actually writing programs. The idea that programming a computer can be done metaphorically instead of in the traditional, painstaking manner is a major lesson taught by Macintosh. So, while thousands of people use the program to organize information, most of the millions of people owning HyperCard never bother with HyperTalk. On the other hand, HyperCard's mere presence on millions of Macintoshes was a subtle yet profound cultural milestone. Before HyperCard, those interested in realizing the dreams of Vannevar Bush and Ted Nelson had formed a community that, despite ardent efforts to educate people to their vision, remained on the fringe. These hypertext adherents have been regarded in the same way that linguists treat the fervent proponents of Esperanto, cultists who may have a point to make, but whose cause is doomed. The appearance of HyperCard, the product with hypertext at its heart, changed all that. It was as if the Esperanto people had suddenly been presented with an entirely new culture who spoke Esperanto as their first language. If you look back just 2 years ago, there were literally only two books available with any great mention of hypertext, said a speaker at the Hypertext 89 conference in Pittsburgh. The books were Ted Nelson's. By 1989, there were a dozen books fundamentally about hypertext that I could gather from my office in under 3 seconds. And there are literally scores of others that purport to be about hypertext that are sprouting up like dandelions. That was the intangible benefit of HyperCard, a hastening of what now seems an inevitable reordering of the way we consume information. On a more basic level, HyperCard found several niches, the most prevalent being an easy-to-use control panel or front end for databases, providing easy access for files, pictures, notes, and video clips that otherwise would be elusive to those unschooled in the black arts of information retrieval. Thus, it became associated with another use of Macintosh that would become central to the computer's role in nudging digital technology a little closer to the familiar, multimedia. In recent years, multimedia has taken on a negative connotation in the computer industry. The term is often used with a suspicious fuzziness, and is often dismissed as a meaningless buzzword, tainted by hucksters invoking the word to move new hardware. Stripped of its gloss, however, multimedia is simply this: the integration of the technologies of entertainment, stereo sound, animation, video, with heavy-duty information processing. Multimedia is the attempt to make computers behave like television sets, only interactively. Macintosh, in its bitmap refusal to discriminate between text and graphic, was a natural platform for this nascent technology. It had the potential to bring the Macintosh magic to a much wider audience. In a sense, mapping other media into computers was inevitable. Despite the advances of the Mac interface, a substantial percentage of the public, probably the majority, still mistrusted computers and had little desire to master them. Yet these same people spent a numbing proportion of their days transfixed by technology: the telephone, the stereo, the radio, the high-speed printing press, and above all, the television. Imperceptibly to the consumer, all of those old technologies were well on their way to transforming themselves. Their appearances seemed no different, but the signals that produced those appearances were changing to digital format, a lingua franca for experience for the next century. The day would come when, like snake shedding skin, they would suddenly show their true colors and be transformed into a single multimedia exclamation point. That day isn't here yet, but you can glimpse it by playing with Macintosh circa the early 1990s. While you struggle to evoke prose from your word processor, punctuated perhaps by verbal notations injected by use of the built-in microphone that comes with almost every Macintosh, you could also devote part of your screen to viewing a complete movie, A Hard Day's Night, or a porno flick entitled Further Adventures of Buttman. And then you can capture a frame from the picture and place it in your document, or even append an entire scene to the document, storing it in a format developed by Apple called QuickTime. With the right software, you can even get a visual scan of the vocal message you just added, and by fiddling with a few horizontal scroll bars, you could change the pitch or even the content, maybe even changing the sound from a human voice to a Hammond organ. The software could help you digitally edit music produced on your desktop recording studio by use of a standard called MIDI, which is sort of a postscript for synthesizers. If you wish, it's even possible to tinker with a film's montage, rearranging the scenes, perhaps even intermingling them with video clips taken with your camcorder, reading them into a Macintosh with an attachment called Video Spigot. You can place a photographic portrait on an Apple flatbed scanner, read the information into it, and using software with exotic names like Digital Darkroom, alter the reality of that photograph, either touching it up to remove a blemish or performing more drastic cosmetic surgery with a paint program. You could even dabble in what formerly was the sole domain of motion picture special effects, morphing one image to another. A software package called Morph, selling for under $100, does this. To be honest, very little of this is as easy to perform as the classic functions of Macintosh. It takes a little time and probably more than a modicum of brains to master the new skills. Yet, by virtue of the Macintosh consistency, all these tasks are many times easier to pull off than they had been in their previous guises. Expert systems costing thousands of dollars more. The weird turn pro. What all these functions have in common is the manipulation of digital information to create a reality that seemed more of a function of the natural world than of the alien computer realm. Macintosh's first step was to create the subtle virtual reality of its interface. Step 2, pull the trappings of the outside reality into this virtual world. Was there a logical destination that could be plotted by this trajectory? John Sculley seemed to think so. His beliefs and desires were reflected in a creation of his own, like Kay's Dyna book, an obvious inspiration, especially considering that the Apple chairman regularly met with Kay. Sculley's creation was a fantasy construct that would never be tested by engineering or marketplace realities. It served two purposes: a glimpse into the future of Apple's products, as sketched by the company's leader, and a bid for Sculley himself to be admitted to the pantheon of technological visionaries. The man who, as a frustrated adolescent, drafted doom plans for a television tube would now have his visage alongside the other giants, the virtual Mount Rushmore of the information age. He called his invention the Knowledge Navigator, a future generation Macintosh, which we should have early in the 21st century. As he wrote in his book, Odyssey, subtitled A Journey of Adventure, Ideas, and the Future. Imagine the Knowledge Navigator having two navigational joysticks on each side, like pilot's controls, allowing you to steer through various windows and menus, opening galleries, stacks, and more. You might even be set free from the keyboard, entering commands by speaking to the navigator. What you see on the large, flat display screen will likely be in full color, high-definition, television-quality images, full pages of text, graphics, computer-generated animations. What you hear will incorporate high-fidelity sound, speech synthesis, and speech recognition. You will be able to work in several of these windows at any time, giving you the possibility to simultaneously compare, for example, the animated structural system of living cells with the animated network of a global economy. Or you might want to explore the depths of Zen philosophy, in which beauty is in the details, comparing it with examples of the architectural details of the Parthenon from ancient Greece, and then contrasting those ideas with the design details of a Japanese camera. Various windows on the display will give you a choice of text, audio, animated graphics, or television quality images, letting you simultaneously grasp ideas through a mix of media alternatives. Sculley's Knowledge Navigator was a pastiche of Bush, Engelbart, Kay, Atkinson, and Dick Tracy. Every aspect of it had already been well traded in the marketplace of ideas. Much of the enabling technology that would be required to realize the device was already being developed in laboratories, waiting only for Moore's Law to drive down the price. Yet Sculley won acclaim for his futuristic paste-up job. This success was due in part to a series of long-form virtual commercials for the Knowledge Navigator. Talking to George Lucas one day, Sculley wondered aloud if it would be possible to exploit the kinds of cinematic special effects used in the Star Wars series to dramatize the Navigator. Thus was born a series of 5-minute documentaries that simulated a product current technology could not realize. Apple's industrial design group mocked up a laptop-sized Navigator, It folded out like a bound notepad and had deco trimmings, as the repeating element in this anthology. The first episode was typical. A Berkeley professor engaged his device in a colloquy intended to prepare his lecture notes for a class he would later teach that day. True to the politically correct Apple ethos, the class was to consider the phenomenon of global desertification triggered by destruction of the rainforest. The professor, a somewhat self-absorbed twit, really, addressed his comments to a part of the display screen that depicted an image of a raw young man in a bow tie. He appeared to know everything about the life of the Navigator's owner and devoted his own virtual life to performing any digital chores the professor could conceivably require. If you wanted to be nice about it, you would call him a factotum. Less charitably, he was a slave made out of software. If for some reason he got out of line, his owner could drag him to the trash can and replace him with a more obsequious icon. When the professor requested animated visuals that vividly illustrated the extent to which humanity was raping the rainforest, the Navigator quickly gathered the information from the hypertext library stored in humankind's vast digital archives, crunched the calculations, and extrapolated the results on a high-definition map that would shame USA Today's graphics department. But the strangest part of the video occurred when the bow-tied slave located a recent paper by Jill, an associate of the professor's. When he heard this, he asked his digital assistant to get her on the phone so he could ask if she'd speak to his class, remotely, of course. Anticipating his request, the Navigatoid had already contacted her. And poof, there she is on the screen, a real human being appearing in a window underneath the square displaying the virtual twit. At least we viewers think she's real. Though the video offers no direct evidence that forces us to consider this possibility, upon a second viewing, I had a frightening realization that aside from some toothless bannering, Jill's appearance and behavior was not really more human than that of the bow-tied homunculus. What if she were not the professor's colleague, but Jill's own software agent? Macintosh teaches us to regard all sorts of media, from sound to text to video, as malleable building blocks, strands of thread we can weave into our virtual reality and change. Will Knowledge Navigator teach us that people are but another medium? I suspect that these musings are more the product of my own imagination than Scully's vision. Such dark speculations were non-existent in the chairman's speeches, where information technology appeared as a benign force solely devoted to making us consider things like the Zen-like principles of Greek facades and Nikon cameras. The future he presented was relentlessly bright. "This is an adventure of passion and romance, not just progress and profit," said John Sculley at the 1988 Macworld Expo. "Together we set a course for the world which promises to elevate the self-esteem of the individual, rather than a future of subservience to impersonal institutions. The 21st century Knowledge Navigator shows us that the journey to evolve the amazing Macintosh has only just begun." Yet at the same time Sculley first began propounding his views on the Knowledge Navigator, Apple itself was failing miserably in bringing a portable Macintosh to market. The first effort of this was called the Macintosh Portable. For over a year, the company had whetted the appetites of Mac cultists, promising that Apple would deliver a no-compromise package that contained all the Macintosh magic in one easy-to-carry package. But by 1989, when Apple delivered the portable, it had compromised the essence of the project, portability. In its attempt to deliver, undiluted, the experience of working with Macintosh on a desktop, Apple gave birth to a beige elephant. It weighed almost as much as the original Macintosh, and cost twice as much. It was the worst excess of the testosterone-charged Gasse era at Apple. For a few weeks in the autumn of 1989, I lugged around a review copy with me when I visited the Bay Area. The portable's main advantage was exercise. Its density roughly approximated that of barbells. It was far too big to fit on an airline tray. I wound up trying to take notes on it while balancing it on my knees. In 10 minutes, my circulation had stopped, and in the interest of maintaining a good relationship to my lower body, I flicked off the portable. Even when it was perched on a desktop, however, the portable was an annoying computer. The designers had implemented all sorts of features to preserve the life of the lead-acid batteries that helped add to the machine's ponderous avoir du poids. Apparently, no one had realized that at its present size, the portable was so unportable that it would rarely be transported to locations, the beach, Mount McKinley, where electrical outlets were not plentiful. I did hear that an astronaut took it into orbit, a development that does little to affirm one's confidence in NASA. Finally, the liquid crystal screen display, though fairly sharp for its time, did not have backlighting. It required outside illumination. The enormity of this lapse was apparent to me when, during the review period, I happened to be in the newsroom of the San Francisco Examiner on the evening of the big 1989 earthquake. The building's power was off, and the staff was hastily cobbling together the next day's edition by using portable computers. None were Macintosh portables. In the gloom, only machines with backlit screens could be put into service. Ironically, the files were later translated to Macintosh format so the earthquake edition of the paper could be desktop published and printed elsewhere. It was not until 1991 that Apple was able to muster the wherewithal to compress the Macintosh experience into a notebook-sized computer. It was called the PowerBook, a conscious nod to Alan Kay's Dynabook. At one of the early Macintosh retreats, Steve Jobs had written on a blackboard, "Mac in a book in 5 years." He was only off by a few years. In contrast to the portable's out-of-touch design process, Apple directed the PowerBook's creators to observe the way people actually used technology. As a result, the designers felt flexible enough to toy with changing the shape and feel of a Macintosh while remaining true to its spirit. The PowerBook has an entirely new look, different not only from both branches of his parent family, the compacts like the original Mac and the new Mac Classic, and the modulars like the Mac 2 and the Mac LC, but distinct from the laptops of his competitors. Most visually startling was the keyboard component. It occupied only the top portion of the base. Below it was a roomy wrist pad for ergonomic comfort and an easily handled trackball that performed the work of the mouse. It was the best Macintosh since the original. Like its forerunner, it spun a compelling mystique, coming to life with a distinctive chime. The clear, well-lit monochrome screen, backlit of course, swept you into the familiar world of Macintosh. Yet something about the package, a stately gray exterior that cracked open like a clam, with keyboard on one side and screen on the other, made the experience even more intimate. Since it was sufficiently compact to carry on a crosstown jaunt, PowerBook people loaded it with very personal files, information relating not only to business matters, but the detritus of their private lives. People wound up relating to it as if it were a diary. Inexpensive modems went inside PowerBooks to make them communication centers, digital telephones, and fax machines. The cumulative effect was as though Apple had reached out into the void and bottled the future, as neat a trick as catching moonbeams. Apple sold $1 billion worth of PowerBooks in its first year, and it could have sold more if its suppliers had been able to produce them. PowerBooks became status symbols. USA Today reported that Hollywood screenwriters literally slept with their Model 170s. Newsweek, in an article about the Young Turks in the Clinton administration, reported that the battle cry in the White House was, "More PowerBooks." One of the most interesting applications designed specifically for the PowerBook involved reading. A company called Voyager published on floppy disks an ambitious list of books skewed to the Mac crowd, like William Gibson's cyberpunk thrillers, current bestsellers, the latest from Gloria Steinem to John le Carré, and classic works of literature, the works of Random House's Modern Library, Dostoevsky to Eudora Welty. The expanded books project flew in the face of continual scoffing from a literary establishment that had always regarded computers as the antithesis of art, but the original designers of Macintosh would have found it a good match for their own work of art. This is an effort to find a place for literature in the dynamic medium that's represented by the computer, rather than see the future to MTV, Voyager's president Bob Stein said at a conference in 1993. The goal at this stage in the information age was twofold. We wanted it to look enough like a book that readers would say, "I recognize that. It's a book," and not throw up at the idea of reading on a screen. We also wanted to keep intact a book's functionality. We couldn't provide the fetishistic relationship to the object, and we didn't want readers to lose too much or they wouldn't like it. As Stein admitted, the experience of reading Dickens or Ken Kesey on a PowerBook could not provide the tactile intimacy of ink on bound paper. But as with other successful software metaphors, these virtual books could outperform their traditional counterparts in other ways. Since the text of the book was stored as an electronic document, the reader could interact with it as if it were a word processing document. Searching for words and phrases was instant, and any passage could easily be copied and dropped into an original document. Voyager also added new materials to each work, accessible, hypertext style, by clicking at the proper link in the original document. During the reading of Moby Dick, you can get a QuickTime video of a roiling ocean. Pictures of dinosaurs popped up in Jurassic Park. It was yet another case in which Macintosh pointed to, and hastened, a future where we might interactively consume and reshape all our information from a vast library of ones and zeros representing the accumulated wisdom, expression, and knowledge of humankind. Clearly, if Vannevar Bush had lived to be 102, he would have bought a power book. Chapter 11. And now a confession. For much of the preparation of this book, ostensibly an homage to an insanely great instance of technology, I have been locked in a battle with my protagonist. For weeks, something had been awry with my Macintosh 2CX, a 1989 successor to the Mac 2. Every time I walked away from the computer for 10 minutes or so, I would return to find the screen frozen. When I moved the mouse, the cursor icon, the little arrow that survived the journey from Xerox PARC to the Lisa to Macintosh, moved with it, but that was the sole response I could evoke. I could not type, I could not pull down a menu, I could not open an application by selecting an icon and double-clicking. The machine had hung. The only thing I could do was switch off the computer and be thankful that I compulsively save my working files every time I wander away from my desk. A properly working Macintosh is a marvel, but a Macintosh with an undiagnosed software problem is slow torture. Is the trouble caused by a faulty program? There are more potential culprits on my desktop than suspects in a game of Clue. A virus? I use an antiviral program to intercept these virtual parasites, but even the best of these claim protection from only all known viruses. Techno-anarchists and Bulgarian virus factories churn out new strains with distressing regularity, so the effort to stay current is as hopeless as a vow to avoid the flu. Then there are the sorts of system problems triggered by the sheer complexity caused by an ensemble of programs running simultaneously. A typical Macintosh has come to accommodate several applications running at once, in addition to as many as a couple dozen system extensions. The latter are software programs that, upon startup, lodge a tiny piece of themselves into the computer's memory in case they are needed, sort of a camel with a nose under the tent. As with any family of independent-minded sorts attempting to occupy a limited space, conflicts can arise within a given ensemble of software files. Programmers try to avoid them, but they are a consequence of the sheer complexity that arises when more and more rowdy occupants are shoehorned into a single vehicle. All of this comes as a consequence of Macintosh's success. The original Mac, while certainly not immune to system failures, was incapable of this sort of elusive malady. You barely had room for the operating system in a single application. The fail-safe method of dealing with a software problem was to make another copy of the disk that came with the application. If the problem persisted, you'd know it was faulty software, and you would either call the developer to complain, and probably hear that others had already reported the bug, and a fix was on the way. If not, you would avoid that application. In any case, you would have identified the problem. But then Macintosh grew. Hard disk drives increased the amount of storage from the equivalent of a large manuscript to something approximating the combined verbiage in a Borders bookstore. The Mac's memory chips were called upon to handle not just a single application in the system, but several applications, as well as the new class of memory resident system extensions. Meanwhile, the system itself had grown to Brobdingnagian proportions. In much the same way that a successful new business, as its income rises from thousands to millions to billions, finds itself mired in bureaucracy, the Macintosh software system, elegant interface and all, is somewhat overwhelmed by its new demands. It has been said that the lifespan of a new personal computer is akin to that of a dog. Each year of a computer's life is equivalent to 7 human years. Using that analogy, a computer really doesn't mature until it is close to 3 years old, reaches its prime between the 4th and 5th years, and gets visibly long in the tooth after year 8. By the end of a decade, it requires artificial means of life support. Since the ecology of personal computers is rather harsh, however, very few computers are privileged to die natural deaths. The vast majority succumb to inborn disease or predators. In the entire, admittedly brief, history of the industry, the only machines surviving to old age have been the Apple II, the IBM PC and its clones, and Macintosh. In order to keep Macintosh fresh and competitive, Apple had to extend its abilities while not pricing itself out of the marketplace. Through the magic of Moore's Law, this was easily accomplished. The 1984 original Macintosh cost $2,500 and was all but unusable without a $400 external floppy drive. In exchange for that $2,900, Apple provided the buyer with 128K of internal memory and a total of 0.8 MB of floppy disk storage. 9 years later, the lowest-powered Macintosh was called a Mac Classic 2. It had an advanced processor that ran programs many times the speed of the original, came with 4 MB internal memory, 32 times as much as the original, a single floppy drive that not only held almost 3 times as much information per disk as the original, but also had the ability to read disks formatted with information from DOS systems, and a built-in hard disk drive with 40 MB of permanent storage. It cost less than $1,000. To accommodate that power, Apple had rewritten the system several times while attempting to maintain the same original intuitiveness of the original Mac interface. At a certain point, this became impossible. The paradigm of files within folders, for instance, was quite elegant and comprehensible when one had a few dozen documents. It was just like a file cabinet. But when users commonly had thousands of documents in their hard disk drives, things became immeasurably complicated, as if the imaginary file cabinet filled the gymnasium. After years of talking about it, Apple finally released a new version of the system and Finder, called System 7.0, which, among other things, dealt with this problem in part by introducing the concept of an alias. This feature allowed you to create multiple icons for each document or folder. So, if you created a letter to your boss about a tennis date, you could put an alias for the document in a business correspondence folder, a tennis folder, and a recent work folder. The document's icon would appear in all of these, and double-clicking on it would open the file, regardless of whether or not the original actually lived in that particular folder. Once you learned how to use aliases, Macintosh life was a bit easier, but the point was one had to learn how to use them. It was one of dozens of new twists that, in the aggregate, made Mac less intuitive. Not to be bested by the system, the applications themselves had grown bigger and more Byzantine in manners not anticipated when Mac was first conceptualized. A good example is Microsoft Word, which became the most popular Macintosh word processor after Apple stopped including free versions of MacWrite with every computer. Originally, Word fit quite neatly on a single 400K floppy disk. It did its job with a minimum of distracting bells and whistles. But Word 5.0, released in 1992, was another matter. Microsoft had stuffed it with features, including a spell checker, a grammar checker, a thesaurus, a drawing program, footnotes, bullet charts, automatic indexing, page layout capabilities, a table of contents generator, drop caps, envelope addresser, a separate facility to generate mathematical notation, and a screensaver that filled the display monitor with spacey color graphics when the machine was not in use. Word 5 filled up 5 floppy disks, and installing it took up the better part of a morning. And Word was by no means the biggest program. I have seen some filling up 9 floppy disks. Macintosh had become so complicated that in 1991, not long after Apple shipped System 7, it released a new program called At Ease. It was essentially what is called a shell, an interface to the interface, used to protect novice users from getting frustrated by having to negotiate a complicated system best left to so-called power users. An Apple apparatchik once explained it to me. "It's a friendly desktop that replaces the Finder," he said. "It's directed to the home and education market and for people new to the Mac. It helps ensure success for novice users." I was deeply disturbed at this. After all, the Finder, the program that greets all Mac users, was the essence of the experience. It was what was supposed to proclaim, through its intuitiveness and simplicity, that Macintosh was different. This was a computer that was easy to use. "Are you saying," I asked the Apple guy, "that the Finder isn't friendly?" He blanched. I tried to use the word friendlier. There was no doubt that in 10 years, Macintosh had become much more powerful and utilitarian, but a price had been paid. How long would it be before it was time to put the dog to sleep? In any case, this was the background to my Macintosh troubles. The computer had become more complicated than anyone had imagined. Obviously, one of those complications was making my life miserable. The fail-safe solution would be to start from scratch, back up all my documents, then wipe the hard disk clean. Then, in an orgy of disk swapping not experienced since my original Macintosh, I could reinstall the system, reinstall all the applications, reinstall all the system extensions and utility programs and games, and hope the same thing did not happen again. But I could not face the prospect of this task, not in the middle of a book. Such an enterprise would take hours, maybe days. So I enacted a short-term fix. I began stripping the system of possible offenders, beginning with frills I hardly used, continuing with features I found somewhat useful but could live without, and ultimately removing certain programs and utilities I found extremely helpful in my everyday work patterns, but knew their presence could potentially cause the horrible situation I found myself in. I was stepping back in time, making the Mac emulate the simpler, though less useful, computer I had. As I wiped out Super Boomerang, Background Printing, On Location, and Space Saver, I picture myself as astronaut Dave in 2001, determinedly yanking out the chips in the supercomputer HAL with the uncomfortable feeling that I was deconstructing a personality. When I was finished, my Macintosh 2CX was not so atavistic as the thing Daisy, but it was, in a Mac sense, no longer itself. On the other hand, it no longer hung. I knew, however, I would have to eventually solve the problem for good, and some weeks later I finally vowed to do so. The first step was some sleuthing. I reactivated the potentially offending pieces of software one by one, waiting until the problem reappeared. Finally, I thought the culprit was identified. A program called On Location that lived under the pull-down Apple menu on the left side of the screen. Published by On Technology, a company founded by Mitch Kapoor after he left Lotus, this was a searching program that could speedily riffle through all the files on a hard disk to find any given phrase or word. I called On's customer support line and reached a technician who informed me that On Location was normally very sound, but a recent version of a popular program had caused some problems. "Do you have Microsoft Word version 5.1? he asked me. I sure did. Put briefly, there was kind of an allergic reaction between On Location and the brand new edition of Microsoft Word. Oddly, the source of the dispute could be mitigated if I accessed the folder that came with Word entitled Sample Documents, located in a file called Employment Report, and consigned it to the trash can. After this deletion and removal of another possibly offending file, he noted, things would quiet down, my support person predicted. I followed his directions and, poof, no more hanging. In retrospect, I marvel at how the problem arose and was resolved. It was as though having that particular file on my system, along with the pre-existing program, caused the same chaos as a butterfly flapping its wings in Indonesia. The machine's eventual breakdown was the hurricane in Kansas. Who knows what similar entanglements were emerging in the chaos of millions of lines of computer code silently executing on the motherboard of my 2CX. Yes, the riddle was solved. but the experience jarred me into contemplation about my own relationship with Macintosh and with technology itself. The first concerned the degree to which I had become dependent on it. What had become of the suspicious anti-warrior of the 60s, casting reproachful glances at the Temple University Computer Center? He had been turned. He was now a technophile. His compatriots from the rebel days now thought him a nerd. The first thing he did in the morning was switch on a Macintosh 2CX, and the blackness of the screen would suddenly crystallize into the Finder, icons, windows, and menu bar on a sea blue background. He swan-dived, cold, into this informational sea and spent the rest of the day bobbing in and out of it. There was a time, I know, when I conducted much of the same sorts of business I currently engage in, without requiring a machine that makes more calculations in a morning's work than all the combined arithmetical operations of humanity performed by hand over the span of recorded history. But I can't remember what that time was like or how I coped. It was only through the densest fog that I can even remember what it was like using my previous pre-Macintosh command line interface computer. Still, I am hard-pressed for proof that, for all its magic, Macintosh has enabled me to be more productive. I feel that it has, with every inch of my being, but after my recent fiasco with On Location and Word, I sometimes question whether this is an illusion. As it turns out, this question has been bedeviling economists as well. A few years ago, Gary Loveman, a professor at MIT, who has since moved to Harvard, attempted to measure the productivity gains that came with the billions of dollars worth of information technology purchased by American industry. Similar studies measuring the benefits of research and development had conclusively demonstrated that R&D was a solid investment, and that there was no reason to suspect that computer technology would be a different story. But when Loveman ran all the numbers, totaled the investments in information technology, and then compared them to the productivity totals of the industries, he was startled, if not astonished, by the results. There was no positive effect, he said. There may even have been a negative effect. This gap between accepted reality, computers make us more productive, and the quantifiable result, they don't, has come to be known as the productivity paradox. A true puzzler, if computers enable us to get so much work done in a much shorter period of time, why can't we measure it? Where did the productivity go? Some people deny that the paradox even exists, and indeed, more recent studies indicate that the information technology investment is beginning to pay off, in part because of the ease of use of graphical interfaces like the Macintosh. Still, I think the paradox is a useful tool to assess the hours we spend focusing on our tools instead of using them, as in the better part of 2 days I spent trying to locate the source of my Macintosh troubles. This was a process which I had never engaged in back in the bad old days when I toiled on a typewriter. In a certain sense, those days were not bad at all. I never spent a whole morning installing a new ribbon, nor did I subscribe to Remington World and IBM Selectric User. I did not attend the Smith Corona Expo twice a year. I did not scan the stores for the proper cables to affix to my typewriter or purchase books that instructed me how to get more use from my liquid paper. But maybe productivity is not the main benefit from computers. As its designers understood, the point of Macintosh was not to prod you into piling up X more reams of paper, but to change the way you interact with information, to empower you to manipulate information with confidence, to augment your creative powers, and to change the very way you think. Macintosh has certainly expanded my view of information, enabling me to break the barrier between text and graphics. It has placed me into the slipstream of the digital age, probably even reorganizing my thought process to align itself to the point-and-click, cut-and-paste rhythms of Macintosh computing. Some people have actually criticized Macintosh on the grounds that it does change one's thinking. Marcia Peoples-Haleo, an assistant professor of English at the University of Delaware, raised considerable hackles among Macintosh adherents in the academic community by writing an article in Academic Computing entitled "Student Writing: Can the Machine Mame the Message?" In it, she described how the freshman comp papers she received differed according to the computers the students used to compose them. After several semesters of having her students use DOS-based IBM computers, she was shocked at the papers generated by Macintosh users. "Never before in 12 years of teaching had I seen such a sloppy bunch of papers," she wrote. The problem went deeper than punctuation. The Macintosh students wrote in a more casual style. Halia was reminded of the loose colloquialisms of the mass media, and even chose more frivolous subjects to write about. While the IBM students addressed issues like capital punishment and nuclear war, she complained, Mac students chose to write about such topics as fast food, dating, bars, television, rock music, sports, relationships, and phenomena such as the foam popcorn chips that come in many packages. Can the technology be too easy, too playful for young immature writers, she asked. It seems to me the schools with only Macintosh computers may need to alert teachers to the possible effects that using this icon-driven, super-friendly system can have on students' writing. 20 English professors of various institutions signed an indignant riposte directed to academic computing. The most pungent response, however, came from Stuart Multhrop and Nancy Kaplan, associated with the writing programs at, respectively, Yale and Cornell. To restrict argument to a narrow range of topics or to words alone may be defining composition far too narrowly, especially in a world where information takes complex and sophisticated forms. They contended that Macintosh's features, especially the ability to integrate other media into documents, can situate language, spoken, written, and iconographic, in a much richer context than the type or word-processed essay can provide. In fact, they implied, the writing program that did not use Macintosh would doom its students to the backwater of an antique version of literacy. Literacy in the next century may well mean the ability to compose in multiple discursive dimensions and across media, they wrote. If we English teachers are unwilling to expand our notions of writing, we relegate ourselves to the study of the past and the instruments of the past. This was getting interesting. A showdown between the forces of tradition and the rebels with a graphical interface. But before the debate had a chance to develop, it became clear that it might become moot. Why? Because all computers were going to adopt the graphical interface. All of them were going to look like Macintosh. During the 1980s, while some people were falling in love with the Macintosh, and others, including Marsha Peoples Halio and countless MIS managers in corporate America, were resisting its charms, the most powerful human being in the computer industry was working doggedly to ensure that all personal computers, regardless whether they were Apple or its competitors, would work like Macintosh. This was, of course, Bill Gates, the chairman of Microsoft. Gates had been impressed from the start with Steve Jobs' original Mac presentation and immediately launched the division of his company which would produce the most popular applications for Macintosh. But his larger goal was to replace his own lucrative product, DOS. There were two reasons for this desire. The first was a genuine belief that the graphical interface was superior. The second was less altruistic. Microsoft had made its name, and much of its revenues, from operating systems and computer languages, but it wanted to dominate the applications market as well. It nettled Gates that Microsoft's competitors in the applications marketplace, the Lotus spreadsheet, the WordPerfect word processor, the DBase database, dominated those categories in the DOS domain. By ending the DOS era and wiping the slate clean, Microsoft could drive its own products to the top of the software bestseller charts. Gates's first stab at a graphical interface came in 1983. The product was named Windows. It had more in common with the earlier Park interface than with the Macintosh. For instance, its windows were not overlapping, as were Lisa and Max, but tiled on the screen, each one demanding a certain share of the display's real estate. Windows 1.0 was also incredibly slow and hopelessly late. It did not catch on. Neither did Windows 2.3, the next major release. But in 1990, Microsoft released, with unprecedented fanfare, Windows 3.0 and found instant success. In the next 3 years, Microsoft sold 25 million copies of Windows 3.0, and by 1993, the Software Publishers Association was reporting that sales of Windows software exceeded that of DOS and Macintosh combined. in countless tiny ways and a number of significant ones, Windows 3.0 was inferior to Macintosh. It was hampered considerably by the fact that it was not designed from the ground up, but grafted onto the overburdened DOS system. This was a necessity, otherwise it could not run on the millions of previously existing computers of that ilk. All too often, the user could peer through the cracks and see the fault lines underneath. For instance, as with DOS, the names of Windows documents were limited to 8 characters, and one could not bestow names upon individual disk drives and floppy disks. So, while on Macintosh, one could name a file, Letter to Deborah Branscombe, 3493, and save it to a disk named March 1993 Correspondence, with Windows, the file would have to be named something like Burns Let Doc and saved to /B. Yet, for all practical purposes, Windows was Macintosh. Despite the lack of key components like the trash can, the essential operations, double-clicking icons to launch files, for instance, were identical. Applications written originally for Macintosh, like Excel and PageMaker, worked much the same on Windows. For Apple, countering the perception that there was little difference between Macintosh and Windows was a difficult task. Throughout the 1980s, it had commissioned a number of studies that proved Macintosh's superiority over MS-DOS, so now it attempted to do the same thing with Windows. It circulated a study by a leading independent PC testing company called Ingram Laboratories that compared various models of Macintosh and corresponding IBM PCs or compact computers running the same software in Windows versions. The study claimed that the same applications performed better in the Macintosh models, and that Macintosh offered better price performance. Leaving aside a shifty omission, the deck was stacked in Apple's favor by not considering the powerful PC clones among the competition, the very comparison showed that Apple had lost its chief arguing point. For years, it had been futile to equate Macintosh with its counterparts in the personal computer world. The comparison was truly, no pun intended, an apples versus oranges situation. But with Windows 3.0, the oranges had become apples. In fact, by 1990, oh, irony of ironies, it was Microsoft, not Apple, which circulated results of a Temple, Barker, and Sloan study, yet another independent consulting and research firm, concluding that a graphical interface, in other words, Macintosh and its imitators, generates a greater return on information technology investment than a traditional interface like Microsoft's own DOS. In a very large sense, it was a great victory for Macintosh and the vision behind it. All computers were destined to be descendants to Mac. The lessons of Macintosh would percolate throughout the entire personal computing community. Apple, however, would not be doing the teaching. The moment to capitalize on the Macintosh's superiority had been lost. In retrospect, it is clear that John Sculley should have opted for lower-cost Macintoshes several years earlier, and perhaps even widely licensed the Macintosh operating system to outsiders. Then, Macintosh's market share would have been significantly more than its 10-15% of the personal computer industry. Instead of licensing the Macintosh, Sculley made alliances with other companies, agreeing to jointly develop future products. The most startling of these was an agreement forged in 1991 to join with another large company to produce the next generation of computers. Apple's new partner was its former blood nemesis, IBM. IBM! To those of us who recall the rhetoric surrounding Macintosh's introduction, Steve Jobs claiming outright that IBM is out to crush Apple, this shift was straight out of Orwell's 1984, when the three global superpowers would shift alliances on a dime. Apple joining with IBM was like Luke Skywalker strolling off into the sunset with Darth Vader. When Apple's profits dipped in 1993, Sculley wound up leaving his post as Apple's leader. The company's board of directors now considered him too much a visionary and excessively starry-eyed technophile to make the hard decisions necessary to shepherd Apple through the 1990s. Sculley was permitted to retain the title of chairman, but no longer had a direct role in the company's operations. Exactly the fate of Steve Jobs in 1985. The irony was inescapable. Originally hired to anchor Jobs' dreamy fantasies, John Sculley apparently departed because his technological seduction had become too complete. He was running Apple too much like Steve Jobs had. And like Jobs, he was gone within months, still attempting to make a dent in the universe, but no longer at Apple. In Sculley's case, this new launching pad was a relatively obscure company involved in wireless communications. Sculley's replacement was 50-year-old Michael Spindler, whom Sculley himself had imported to Cupertino from his native Germany. A no-nonsense businessman who eschewed publicity and was not known to gush about 21st-century renaissances, Spindler's nickname was the Diesel. There was little danger that the Diesel would become Steve Jobs. Apple had suffered down periods in the past, only to rebound. It was a company that sold $7 billion worth of technology each year, and its product line still featured the best personal computer in the world, Macintosh. It would undoubtedly recover once again, perhaps with the fruits of its collaboration with IBM, a faster computer that Macintosh called the PowerPC. But another milestone had been passed. It seemed that at Apple, eras, like computers, are measured in dog years. The changes at Apple bring me back to my dinner conversation with Steve Jobs in November 1983, just before Macintosh was introduced. He was talking about the future of Apple. "Something happens to companies when they get to be a few billion dollars," he said. "They sort of turn into vanilla companies. They add a lot of layers of management. They really get into process rather than result, rather than products. They lose touch with their customers. Their soul goes away. And that's the biggest thing that John Sculley and myself will get measured on 5 years from now, 6 years. Were we able to grow to a $10 billion company that didn't lose its soul?" I think Macintosh accomplished everything we set out to do and more, even though it reaches most people these days in Windows, says Andy Hertzfeld today. We loved the Apple II, and we loved art. So we made the Mac a descendant of the Apple II and a computer for artists, for writers and musicians. We never doubted that the way we did things would catch on. The key thing is we kept the Apple II spirit, the crazy irreverence, the anti-authority flavor. Macintosh tells people as they use it, you don't have to take things too seriously. It was great to make a product that has a rebel heart. He pauses. And what I'm doing now is in that straight line, in that spirit. What is Andy Hertzfeld doing now? Helping to create the spiritual successor to Macintosh. He is a co-founder of a startup company called General Magic. Nestled in the cubicles of the General Magic engineering department is virtually a Mac Hall of Fame. In the corner sits Bill Atkinson, the corporation's chairman. Next to his cubicle is Hertzfeld, the inspiration to the young hackers on staff.